This is KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. When Voltaire ends Candide with the famous declaration, "Il faut cultiver notre jardin," we should view the garden in question against the background of the wars, pestilence, and natural disasters evoked by the novel. But who is the new? Candide and his comrades? The citizens of France? Humankind in general? And what does the garden refer to? To the plot of private land that Candide retreats to after his adventurous odyssey? To his troubled nation? To the social or moral virtues that are lacking in the public sphere, but that can be cultivated privately? To the values that keep us sane when all else goes to pot? Je ne sais pas. Il faut cultiver notre jardin. We must cultivate our garden. Now that's a dictum I hold to. And in my opinion, the imperative of self-cultivation has done more to enhance human relations than anything besides running hot water. Some things, like good genes or a vigorous liver, are given to us as gifts. But most of our personal, social, or moral virtues are the fruit of systematic cultivation. As Yeats once put it, "Hearts are not had as gifts, but hearts are earned by those who are not entirely beautiful." And he went on to say, we must labor to become beautiful. Because even beauty, more often than not, is an acquired quality. Just ask Anouk Aimée. Over the centuries, no one in the Western world has labored harder to become beautiful than the French. Whether it's the aristocracy of the Ancien Régime or the malign bourgeoisie of the 19th and 20th centuries, self-cultivation has long been a prime French directive. Il faut cultiver soi-même. The Greeks and Romans had highly developed traditions of culture de soi, as Michel Foucault called it. They cultivated virtues like prudence, wisdom, and temperance. But the French taught us something new. They taught us that vices are every bit as cultivatable as virtues. Indeed, even more so. For French sensibility, a highly refined vice is far more beautiful than an earnest virtue. It is precisely because vices are so susceptible to the transfigurations of form that they thrive in highly formal settings like the court of Versailles. The cultivation of envy, spite, vanity, mean-spiritedness, pride, sloth, or greed does not transform vice into virtue. On the contrary, by submitting such vices to extremely formalized rules and protocols, it gives them a style that renders them sublime, while leaving their vicious essence intact. Il faut cultiver nos vices. And speaking of cultivating one's garden, think of the gardens of Versailles. The idea for the Versailles gardens came to Louis XIV on the evening of August 17, 1661, when Louis's finance minister, Nicolas Fouquet, unveiled the magnificent gardens he had had built for himself at a place called Vaux-le-Vicomte. So sublime and awesome were these gardens that Louis XIV promptly stormed out of them in a rage. The next day he had his minister arrested and cast into a dungeon, where Fouquet languished for the rest of his long life, never to be pardoned by the king, despite many earnest appeals on his behalf from various quarters. Now, no doubt the sumptuousness of the Vaux Gardens suggested that only a corrupt minister could afford such luxury. But Fouquet's offense in Louis's mind was graver than that. The gardens were a gesture of pride vis-à-vis the king himself, for only the king was entitled to such splendor. Just as Lucifer in his pride overreached his station and sought to be the equal of God, so too Fouquet had done the same with the king. And just as God cast Lucifer into the depths of hell, so too Louis threw his minister Fouquet into a dungeon. Yet at the heart of Louis's regal indignation, there was a good deal of envy as well. So jealous was the king of what he saw that night at Vaux-le-Vicomte, that after punishing his minister, he promptly hired Fouquet's entire team of architects, gardeners, and engineers, and initiated the project of building the gardens of Versailles. Thus, what we see in Versailles today is a magnificence born of jealousy, wounded vanity, and rivalrous imitation. And what about overbearing pride? If pride is defined by overreaching, can a king be prideful? He can be so only with respect to God, yet it is precisely in his arrogation of the powers and stature of God on earth that the absolute monarch remains the living incarnation of superbia. Never had the Christian sin of pride institutionalized itself so unabashedly as it did under the absolute monarchy of Louis XIV. The gardens of Versailles were designed with one overriding purpose in mind, namely to exalt the Sun King and reaffirm his analogical kingship with God. In that regard, they put pridefulness on open display and gave it one of the most exalted forms it would ever take, without in the least extenuating its vice. And yet, despite this vicious matrix, or better, because of it, Versailles remains one of the most cultivated gardens in the world. In the next hour, we're going to talk with one of the world's leading scholars of the French Ancien Régime. And in particular, we're going to talk to him about some of the sublime vices that run through its society, its politics, and its competing ideologies. His name is Pierre Saint-Amand, a professor of French literature at Brown University. I'm taking advantage of his brief visit to Stanford to bring him into the studios of KZSU so that he can share with us his eminently entitled opinions about the covert as well as overt passions of the so-called Age of Reason. Pierre, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you, Robert, for this invitation.
Now, Pierre, I don't usually do this with my guests, but your background is somewhat out of the ordinary, so I'd like to start with some personal bio, if you don't mind. You're Haitian by birth.
Yes.
And you grew up in Port-au-Prince, is that right?
Yes, I grew up in Port-au-Prince during I spent most of my childhood, you know, during the reign of the infamous François Duvalier, then his son, and I was a young student going to what is called the collège, you know, lycée there in Haiti, and I left finally to come to North America to attend university.
I take it the lycée was a French lycée?
It was a French lycée. It was I belong to two different lycées, and the story is actually quite interesting. I was first in a... there were two private schools One of them was directed by French priests who were exiled by François Duvalier because the then president thought that they were their ministry was becoming too problematical and spreading dangerous words, and they were all exiled.
Were they Jesuits?
No, they were actually Marist priests.
Yes, yeah.
And when they left, then my father took me to another school where I finished my
What age
my,
were you
my
when
lycée.
What age were you during that period of
Let
transition?
Me see, I must have been 14, 15. Yeah.
Did those exiled priests before their exile have a lasting influence on your education or your at least your personal recollections of your youth?
I don't really think so. The ones that really had the transition to the other school, I think, was in a way, although I liked being in the school that I was before, but I think the second school had much more influence with me, on me. There were a school that was formed by a series of professors that had returned a long time ago to France for their own studies, and I was educated by them. One had returned from France and had studied mathematics, another one philosophy, and another one was a prominent professor of literature who had was one of the leading specialists of Haitian literature. His name is Pradel Pompidus. So I was educated by those people, and I thought then as a student that I was privileged to have had these people, and they always instilled in me the desire to become actually a professor.
Right.
And
And then you went on to become a professor of the humanities and in literature in particular. Was that an interest that you knew you had already back then?
Well, you know, my father was a teacher himself. He was a principal of a school and a great lover of literature. This is one of the rare things that I actually shared with him. I was educated by a very authoritarian father, and we had some clash when I was young. But literature was one of the rare domains where we got along and we shared some affective bond.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew. I did not know, but teaching was basically there. I think I inherited that from him.
So you came to North America, and you had you really, I think you're one of the youngest people, if not the youngest person, to get a PhD in America. Is that right?
Probably not, but yes, I was.
You were how old were you when you got a dissertation from Johns Hopkins University in French literature?
I think I was 23.
23 years old, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you have to be one of the youngest. I mean, maybe Nietzsche beats you. When you were the youngest full professor, if you want. But you became a full professor pretty quickly, too.
That's true.
When you pursued graduate study at Hopkins, you ended up deciding to work on the 18th century.
Yes, and I started being trained to actually work on the 20th, and I switched over to the 18th. I don't exactly know when the passage to the early modern period became important for me, but my great interest was always actually to work on the 17th, but I felt more comfortable working in the 18th because of the mix between literature and philosophy, which was always an interest to me.
Yeah.
I don't consider myself a philosopher, really, but I always have interest in philosophy, and the language of philosophy itself has an interest for me. And so the 18th century allows me to go between the two discourses.
Your dissertation, I believe, was on Diderot, is that correct?
My dissertation was on Diderot, Le Labyrinthe de la Relation, and it was mostly on the scientific writings of Diderot. When I wrote that dissertation, very few people, it was actually close to the bicentennial of Diderot's birth, but there was very little interest in Diderot, really, and I think I was able to rekindle some interest in this sort of strange. Diderot was perceived as being sort of a strange philosopher, but I wrote on the connection between his scientific writings and his other writings around the concept of the complicated, the complex, basically working around the notion of disorder, which was a main concept for Diderot.
It was also very much in the air, I believe, in the early 80s. And you were at the right place. You had
I was at the right place at the right time. It was Prigogine was around. And
was René Girard at Hopkins?
René Girard was also there.
And Michel Serres.
And Michel Serres was
both
there.
Of whom have migrated now to Stanford.
Indeed. So I was, I think, around the listening to Michel Serres and also Prigogine, who came to Johns Hopkins, I could see that there was a precursor of their theories in Diderot, and there was a line of sort of Lucretian philosophy.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And that conference at Hopkins on order and disorder, I believe it was.
That was here, actually, at Stanford. That conference.
Yes. Was that here at Stanford?
That was here at Stanford.
Which is the one I'm thinking of at
Hopkins? You're thinking of the famous, infamous conference on post-structuralism, no?
Yes. Well,
I wasn't there at that time.
You weren't there, yeah.
That was before my time.
Those were times when academic conferences still could have
something.
Huge impact and resonance and consequences. Now, you know, they happen every day and... our words just kind of float into a void and disappear there. Anyway, Pierre, after Diderot, your dissertation, I believe that came out as a book.
Yes.
You went on to a new territory, which isn't the intersection between science and literature, but it's a book, a really fascinating book, which in French is called De la Séduction. In English, I believe it was translated as The Libertine's Progress. It came out in 87, originally in French, translated a few years later. This is a book about seduction in 18th century French literature. What was so interesting to you about seduction?
Yes. First of all, I should say that I realized that it was difficult to teach, especially in French department, scientific works that I had worked on. So I progressively abandoned that field to teach what students could manage to read more easily. So I developed teaching the novel, and it is in relationship to my pedagogy that I thought of this book on seduction. I've always was. My attraction, usually on working in a field, is to provoke, in a way, a new interpretation. For the interest in Diderot was that he is a unique, really, philosopher in the Enlightenment, an odd figure, and that was the fascination. And working in seduction was. The interest was basically the same way too. I did not approach it from a point of view of reading the novel the way the specialist of the novel read it. I read the 18th century novel and seduction from a more anthropological point of view. And basically, it was. I read the what can be considered a modern phenomenon, a modern cultural phenomenon of libertinism in the 18th century with more archaic connection. Basically, the clash of these individuals. It was more the those relationships of seduction that I wanted to study, and I read them between model and agent, model and subject.
Right. I have read the book, and it's been a while. But it's not that you propose a theory of seduction in general, that, as far as I recall, but there is definitely a theory of desire as it works in the ambit of the 18th century French novel, no?
Yes.
Where seduction is also a means of rivalry and of sublimated violence. Is that going too far?
No, that's it. And yes, and I show that the novel of the 18th century provides actually a genealogy of this desire. The novel of the 18th century, going from Marivaux all the way to the novel of Sade, is give us an anthropological blueprint, basically, of this progress of desire. Desire itself becomes more and more violent, and relationships become more and more lethal when we go from Marivaux to Sade, and all of that is done by this mimetic process and this clash of vanities, basically.
So, well, I have two questions. One, uh-huh. Would you say then that what some of the remarks I was making in my opening lead in about the cultivation of vices or the rendering of them in giving them style is something that really takes place in the phenomenon of seduction in the 18th century novel? In other words, you don't have brute violence. It's not an uncultivated thing.
It
has taken on a certain refinement, but it still hasn't lost its vicious.
Not at all. It is sort of performed violence, highly ritualized violence. A lot of people were shocked. For example, there is in the famous Laclos novel, Les Liaisons Dangereuses, there's been a lot of interpretations of the end of the novel with the expulsion of La Marquise de Merteuil. I gave to that particular episode a much more anthropological background by very distinctly and meticulously showing how the novel places her at the end as a victim of this community, and the way her place, the way she becomes scapegoated at the end.
Although she's a participant in the same process, no?
She's a participant in the same process, but the collective finds in her a way to redeem itself,
yeah.
And she is expelled. And an anthropological point of view allows us to see that much better, and to give to the contagion of relations in the novel a much more ample feature.
So by the time you get to Sade, however, I think your book there ends on Sade, there's no more sublimation or highly ritualization and formalization of the violent foundations of seduction and desire, but a kind of unmasking of it in a way that I believe. Would you agree that it gives the game away?
And Sade is important in that way. Usually, Sade is studied in disconnection with the rest of the 18th century. With the readings that I do, we can read Sa'd in a continuum rather than in disconnection. The forms may be parodied, they may in Sa'd, but yet they enlighten the rest of the century. It's not in the readings that I provide. We no longer can see Sa'd as an absurdity of the period, but really a monstrous apogee.
Yeah. He's not even the unconscious. He's the, or even the subconscious. He's the unmasking of the driving principle. I don't want to go too far, obviously.
That's what I like to. That's the way I like to see it.
Now you've had a lot of experience over the years teaching these novels to students, and do you find that there's been a change, fundamental change, in the last 10 or 20 years in the reactions that you're finding in the classroom to the libertine novel?
There is always some, especially for Sa'd, there is always some degree of shock, and there is a for the other ones, the libertine novels, which are highly readable, about these aristocrats, there is a level of fascination that remains and that the students have. They
as much today as before?
Not as much, maybe. The entire 18th century becomes more and more difficult to teach as the generations become younger. I realize, maybe I'm getting older myself, but
or maybe enlightenment is getting further and further away from our.
There you go. But I think the fascination, as I was saying, still remains there, and it's a world and a language that is very obscure to them.
Mm-hmm.
They're sometimes, in order to make it accessible, I make it more banal, although I try to, at the same time, to take them away from that banality by talking about sexual proclivity and things like that, although I don't think it has anything to do with that, only.
I'm glad that I teach things like Dante and Petrarch. I would find it very difficult and frustrating to try to get American students to imagine what a French 18th century aristocratic world was like. The degree, the kind of obsession with one's rank in the social hierarchy, the vanity, the kind of extreme vanity of the actors there, the mimetic contagion.
They don't understand.
No, it's very hard,
all,
I think,
yes.
For
yes.
The passions of that century to be translated into our terms. Yeah.
And more, when I teach now the literature, I start with basic ideas about that society, about rank, about hierarchy, and then I progressively make them enter into this strange world.
I was reading a quote the other day, I guess in preparation for our conversation, about this wasn't Louis XIV, but there was some priest, Jansenist, who had died, and he was buried in a cemetery, and followers came there, and they thought that he was a saint, and they were eating dirt. Anyway, the king's authorities came in there, and they cordoned off the place, and they put up a sign, "De par le roi, défense à Dieu de faire miracle en ce lieu."
Uh-huh.
We are forbidding God to perform miracles in this place.
De par le roi.
De par le roi. So the king, yes. The king, by the king's order, God shall not perform miracles in this. How can one imagine the depth of presumption that such a edict would you know, entails or assumes. It's just
it is a very interesting and peculiar edict in many ways. The king being, of course, the representative of God on earth, yet there in that particular edict, you have the effacement of one majesty over the other.
No, I'm with Dante on this whole issue. Dante thought that kings were just petty tyrants, and he had no use for them in his political providential order. An emperor, okay, one emperor, but all these petty little kings around absolute monarchs, that's a different discussion. Piet, after Seduction, you went on to write a fascinating book on what we call the French philosophes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we still call them even in English philosophes because many people don't consider them philosophers in the Anglo-Saxon sense of metaphysicians and so forth. These are Voltaire, Diderot, and Rousseau and so forth. And this is a book that you entitled in French Les Lois de l'Hostilité, The Laws of Hostility. It came out also in English in the mid-90s. What is that book about?
Yes, and in many ways, both books are connected. The Seduction book and The Laws of Hostility, they both deal with underside of the Enlightenment, and they both deal with the foreclosure of violence that is usually connected with the Enlightenment. The laws of hostility, laws is a shorthand for the philosophies of contract that are developed around that time.
And by contract, you mean social contract.
Social contract. Yeah. And it's a play also on the Montesquieu's famous Esprit des Lois. What I wanted to show in that book is, and there again, is to read the 18th century upside down, start with Montesquieu's majestic Esprit des Lois, and go on with Rousseau. Both of them are sort of philosophers of goodwill. There was an American historian who spoke about philosophies of decency in the 18th century, and to read them in light of Diderot and Sade, who bring violence back into the social realm. So that is the reason why it's appropriately called, I think, the laws of hostility.
I remember also that one of the things that you suggest is that, especially among these philosophers of goodwill, who believed in the general benevolence of human nature, the non-aggressive thing, that they had displaced it into their own rivalry among themselves.
Indeed, indeed. That's it was interesting to study itself, the space of political philosophy, and the lineage of these philosophers from Hobbes and even before on to study the field itself as a study of hostility and clashes between them. You say that, I'll say you'll say X, I'll say Y, basically. So the field itself becomes more and more mimetic as it progresses.
And I believe,
in other words, you can't have Rousseau without Montesquieu, and you can have Sade without Montesquieu and Rousseau.
To the point where perhaps their behavior belies their theories to a certain extent, no?
In a way.
So you say that Diderot brings violence back into the equation. Sade, obvious, very obvious.
Yes.
There's two philosophers that I'd like to ask you about. Well, one is Voltaire and the other is Rousseau.
Mm-hmm.
You have some pages, I know, on Voltaire.
Yes.
And for my own curiosity, because I began by invoking Candide.
Yes.
And I asked a number of questions, not because I think that I have the answer to them, but it's because I think the novel leaves us with these questions about this dictum, il faut cultiver notre jardin. So can I ask you, what is your opinion about who is the nous? Who are we that must cultivate our garden? And what might Voltaire mean by the garden there?
Yes. Well, I don't know whether I can arrive to a more eloquent rendering of your own perspective on Voltaire. But in the book, I studied Voltaire again with an anthropological lens. And as you recalled very, very wonderfully, the episode in Candide, where the garden is offered as a response, is at the end of the novel, after Voltaire basically takes the reader and Candide through a realm of violence. There are plagues,
earthquakes.
Which you can read anthropologically as events of contagion and indifference, basically. But the garden is in response to that, and a different model of reciprocity is offered there by Candide. And the moment of the garden is a moment of epiphany for Candide. He has those, you know, the in the entire novel, he oscillates between those two philosophers. And there is a pessimistic discourse, and there is an optimistic one. Finally, in the garden, not only does he himself settles that little farm and erects himself as a kind of benevolent pastor, he enunciates his dicton. He says, "Il faut cultiver notre jardin." It's for the first time in the novel, Candide does not hesitate. Reflects back and forth.
Oscillate. Yeah.
He oscillates. He speaks in an affirmative way, and the garden moment is a wonderful moment, you know, of peace basically gained through experience. It's a wonderful suspension in the novel, where all the characters return; they have aged around Candide, and the reciprocity, the model of reciprocity that Voltaire develops there, is a reciprocity of services, and life there, on the sur les bords de la Propontide, on the how do you say that in English,
on
the Bosphorus, is supposed to be a life with living with the minimum.
Yeah,
I think we can still take a lesson from that today.
Oh, absolutely, and I think that if what you're suggesting is indeed the case, namely that history is characterized by, well, disaster, violence, indifferentiation, and so forth, the cultivation,
yes,
of the gardens, whatever the garden represents, whatever kind of virtue, social, personal, communitarian, that and minimalism.
And there is a wonderful episode that people usually don't talk about, when readers insist on the garden, but there is one episode where you see boats with defunct kings across the bay, going by, and
The closest thing we have, and it's only I think an exceptional moment in modern American history, is when JFK says, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." Otherwise, we live more and more in a kind of climate where the citizen has unlimited presumption that the government is there to provide services, to facilitate consumption. And the idea of taking responsibility for cultivation is as alien as you can get, I think, in our own day, where the citizen is called upon to be primarily a consumer. Mm-hmm. And not a cultivator.
Yes.
And in that regard, I think Voltaire's dicton is, that's why I said, I mean, I hold to it.
Yeah, and I think we should think of this moment in the garden as this agricultural celebration.
Yeah. And it can be also expanded allegorically or symbolically the university, the cultivation of the mind, the cultivation of friendship, the cultivation of conversation, various, but even of vices, as I originally said. I mean, if we're not going to get rid of vices, so why not, render them? Why don't we stylize them at least so that they become sublime rather than corrosive?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that is the lesson, I think, of at the end of Candide.
Yeah.
You know, the aging, the return of the aging characters, I think, is key in that sense.
So if we move on, I wanted to speak a little bit about Rousseau, but given that there's not that much time, I wanted to make sure that we get far enough ahead in our conversation before the time runs out on us to ask you why you, if you have any sort of insight to impart to us about why the Ancien Régime in France ended up the way it did, namely decapitation. And was the French Revolution a necessary outcome given everything that had preceded it, or was it something that could have been avoided if certain moves were made at the right time by the right people?
Yeah, I don't know if I can offer an answer. It's a great historical question. In my book, I touch upon the revolution exactly in that terms. There you have all of these philosophers of goodwill, basically, those theoreticians of decency, to return to this term, and then this great moment of the revolution, this explosion of violence that will end up in not only the death of the king, but the replication of all these deaths, this sea of deaths. And the revolutionaries themselves, the men of the terror, they were lawyers, and they were disciples of Rousseau. They were talking, in terms of the natural man,
natural rights,
and natural rights. And on the other side, they were decapitating millions of heads, and for many of them, violence was this supposed to be this foreign thing, this foreign affair. So at the end of the century, what you have, indeed, and this is the reason why you have a lot of, at the end of the 18th century, going to in the 19th, a lot of critics of the revolution, like Joseph de Maistre, would take issue principally with those so-called, what they would call the lawyers of the 18th century, not only in the person of Rousseau, but also in their incarnations of Robespierre and Saint-Just.
But do you think there's a cause and effect relationship between these lawyers having read Rousseau or Montesquieu or the other philosophes and their willingness to resort to a very abstract and unrestrained form of violence in order to achieve political aims? Or were they just bad readers of good philosophers? Or was their reading of those philosophers not relevant at all to their political, the way they behaved as politicians?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a difficult question to answer. You can read Robespierre, for example, as a monstrous deformation of Rousseau and his vision of virtue and the terror as a horrible deformation of Rousseau's general will. I don't know whether I can provide an answer to that. There certainly are, you know, real causes, I think, of the revolution, and there are many.
Well, certainly there's
that. Yeah.
Certainly there's activism among the philosophers of the 18th century. Voltaire, for example, really believed that if with the proper reform in the social political spheres and with enough people committed to changes, you can ameliorate human society, and that this will mean necessarily taking on the vested interests that come to us from the past and from certain classes of society, and that perhaps there is in the philosophy a recognition that a certain amount of violence has to be done in the name of a greater, higher good. No?
Well, I mean, they don't say that, you know, and they're I think for most of the 18th century philosophers, Rousseau, especially, violence is really behind. Behind us, and even Diderot sometimes, you know, uses a language which is confusing, and saying that the time of barbarity is behind us, and we all have become so enlightened.
Yeah. In the period that you work on, there are two in the popular American imagination. Anyway, there are two. Moments or texts or figures that have a power to captivate. One is the Liaison Dangereuse, which we talked about already.
Yes.
The other is a figure of Marie Antoinette, and there's a lot of interest in her. It continues not only in America, but you know, in France as well as elsewhere. And I know that you've worked on Marie Antoinette. What is it about this Austrian woman who was a victim of the revolution that so fascinates?
Yes. You know, the interest, of course, in her today, she is basically, if I may provide a reading, of, you know, especially thinking about the movie by Sofia Coppola, she's seen between a cross between Lady Di and Paris Hilton.
Yeah.
You know, this woman who came to Versailles very young and become a consumer of all the goods that culture provides. And
that movie got very bad reviews, by the way. I haven't seen it.
Yes, I don't think it's so bad myself, personally. I think they're beautiful views of Versailles. My own fascination with Marie Antoinette, and again, I read her story in an anthropological lens, is this extraordinary reversal in her story between a figure who is celebrated to being despised. She is sort of this narcissistic icon par excellence, and then she is vilified and everything is taken away from her. It's also in her case the way she represent becomes to represent, and usually that's the way she is perceived as a kind of icon of fashion, but a contagious figure par excellence, you know, with all women becoming basically a figure of Marie Antoinette. And her elimination, I think, may have to do with that process. But that may be my own vice of reading.
Right. Is it because she was the queen, or because she had other personal qualities recommending her? She was not beautiful from the historical records, from what we're told, no?
No. She, but she had a...
Not that Paris Hilton is.
No. But she was, she became this sort of constructed figure, you know, of fashion. Right. And she...
Oh, fashion-wise, no doubt, if you see some of those...
Yes, but...
Dresses. What about her garden in Versailles, Pierre? I wanted to ask you about the little...
The little hameau.
Is, yeah.
Yes, yes.
What's that?
Actually, it's been completely refurbished, you know, and I had the opportunity to see it because this is the 250th anniversary of Marie Antoinette, and the garden has been, thanks to a lot of funds, some of them American, have been completely refurbished, and it's quite a beauty. You know, she was a reader of Rousseau. And some of it, you could say that it's also nostalgic. She did not like, when she came to Versailles, she did not like not only the formality of the courtly life itself, and the rigors of it, you know, inherited from the Louis XIV time. She preferred more interiorized, intimate settings. So she retreated not only to the Trianon, but when she had to put her stamp on the garden, she created this very informal, pastoral garden that were more reminiscent of her Austrian life, but also, some say, close to what was being developed at the time by Rousseau, thinking of the English garden. And it's truly beautiful. And I had the opportunity to revisit them this summer, and it was with great joy.
So you said, according to some, I thought it was deliberately and very openly based on Rousseau's contrasting the formality and artificiality of the classical French garden versus the English garden, and that there is just this little oasis of a...
Yes. Well, there is that. I think also there is an element of nostalgia of her Austrian landscape. Mm-hmm. I think it's both, really.
So, in conclusion, when we come back to the biographical, I mean... Do you find...
We're still talking about Marie Antoinette.
No. We're talking now about your career as a 18th-miste, a scholar of 18th century French literature primarily. You do a number of other things, obviously. But the curiosity here is whether there are points of coincidence between your background, growing up in Haiti, and... the history that country has had as an ex-French colony, and your decision to devote your research to the most regal and, in a certain sense, canonized century of the ex-colonizer's history.
Yes, I often ask myself why, I remain in the 18th century and why this is a fascinating century for myself, and why I choose to read it the way I do. And it might, in fact, have to do with a very biographical element, that I always read the 18th century as basically caught between an archaic past made of violence and clashes,
class warfare,
and this a possibility of modernity, and almost utopia. And I wonder sometimes if this is not this chiasmus that I experience in my own.
And do you think there's something distinctive about the French Enlightenment that distinguishes it along the lines you've just described, that distinguishes it from either the English Enlightenment or the American Enlightenment, the Italian? I don't know if Italy ever really had a true Enlightenment, but nevertheless, is there something distinctively French?
Oh, definitely, yeah. The Enlightenment, the French Enlightenment has all of these contradictions, which make it very interesting, and it has this fascinating style, in a way too, which make it so seductive to return to.
And what about the claims to universality that is so much a part of the ideology of the French Enlightenment, and also subsequently becomes part of the fabric of French national identity and French education, especially when it comes to the colonial experience, where the unshakable belief in the universality of the rights of man, for example, and the dictates of reason and so forth, that is this something that you I don't want to say buy into, but is it a faith that you inherited in any way through your French education, or is it something of which you were profoundly suspicious as speaking now as a Haitian?
Yes.
Who is seeing things from another angle?
Yes, and you know, I don't buy in it at all, and I don't reject it the way some do from a sort of post-colonial point of view. There are these days all these study of the others of the Enlightenment, and I think that's very important. There was a great exhibit last year in France about the Enlightenment, Les Lumières, point exclamation, exclamation mark, and there were maybe a few portions reserved to the other side of the Enlightenment, which is the colonial expansion. I believe that my sort of this uncovering of violence, of hostility, those reversals of Enlightenment propositions that I do in my book are a contribution to a de-universalizing of the Enlightenment. So my contribution may not be so readily read as a critique of the Enlightenment, the way a post-colonial one would be, but I do believe that it is nonetheless a contribution in that light also.
A hermeneutics of suspicion, to use an old term.
Exactly. Yeah.
Hermeneutics of, that's great. And I think that's what's most powerful about the kind of perspective that you bring to bear on your own topic. So for those of the people in our audience who have been listening, we've been talking with Pierre Saint-Amand, professor of French literature from Brown, who's visiting here at Stanford, and he's authored three books, his first book on Diderot, and the two books that we've mentioned here in the last hour, one on seduction called The Libertine's Progress, and the other on the laws of hostility. And unfortunately, Pierre, we've run out of time. Otherwise, I was going to ask you about the book that you were just finishing on laziness in the 18th century. And that's another whole topic. Do you want to take a minute or two and just give us a little preview of what that
new project
is about?
Very briefly, it's the same exercise in contradiction. You know, the 18th century is with the emergence of capitalism is seen as the age of industry, And I will be reading a series of authors who are proposing different types of subjectivity, those marred in idleness and laziness, and who retract from the world of labor and discipline.
Fabulous. We'll look forward to that. Thanks for coming on, Pierre.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you.